We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, starting out with local, and the state legislature was still in the kitchen this week.
Oh, they were, and they were working on passing as many bills as they could before the cutoff on Friday, yesterday. And some of the very interesting housing-related bills that passed both houses and are on their way to the governor's desk for signature include some of the following. House Bill 1643 would exempt from the real estate excise tax any property sold to a nonprofit or government entity to be used for affordable housing for low-income people. That one's passed and is going to the governor. Also in that category is House Bill 1724 would establish an advisory committee on permanent supportive housing inside the State Department of Commerce. House Bill 1738 would increase the debt cap for the Housing Finance Commission from $8 billion to $14 billion. House Bill 1793 would forbid housing associations from banning the installation of electric vehicle charging stations as long as they're situated within an owner's unit or parking space. That one is actually an environmental bill, but that's a great bill, too, that passed. House Bill 1818 would allow the Department of Corrections to provide additional services to formerly incarcerated people to keep them from falling into homelessness. So that includes things like extending them rental vouchers from 3 to 6 months, expanding the folks who can receive those vouchers, and repealing fees related to Department of Corrections supervision, which often end up to be a big financial burden on people who are newly released from prison. Now, House Bill 1866 also passed. That would establish a new fund, the Apple Health and Homes Program, to provide permanent supportive housing to folks who face barriers staying in their homes because of their health or medical situation. House Bill 2001 allows tiny houses to be part of an affordable housing incentive program under the state's Growth Management Act. House Bill 2061 adds permanently affordable housing to the list of projects that can be funded using community revitalization funds. Senate Bill 5749 requires that landlords accept personal checks, cashier's checks, or money orders for rent payments, and that tenants be able to make payments by mail or at an accessible on-site location. And it prohibits landlords from requiring tenants to make rent payments electronically with no other options available.
Wow. So hard to believe they needed to do that.
I know. Senate Bill 5758 will require the Housing Finance Commission to start a program to help finance the conversion of rented condos into owned homes for lower income families. Senate Bill 5818 would lift some requirements of an environmental impact statement on certain projects that qualify as affordable housing. So those are some of the great housing-related bills that passed this past week and are on their way to the governor for signature. And there were some more interesting environmental bills that passed both houses and are also headed to the governor, starting with House Bill 1099, which would add the goal of environmental resiliency to the goals listed in the state's Growth Management Act and requires local governments to revise their growth management plans to include steps to address environmental resiliency in their local jurisdiction. Now, when this bill started out, the wording was address climate change. So as it went through the amendment process, the wording addressing climate change was changed to environmental resiliency. So that's kind of interesting. And I think some folks would say it expands the scope of the bill to include things like planning for the effects of climate change, like flooding, rising sea levels, heat waves, droughts, etc. Others would say, well, it kind of waters it down because it focuses only on addressing it accepts climate change as inevitable and focuses only on addressing the effects of it rather than trying to stop it.
I assume they were just trying to hide the purpose of it.
Yeah, that's
using working where nobody understood what it meant.
Yeah, that is possible too. So I think it does. I'm kind of in the camp where I think it needlessly focuses on the addressing the impacts of the inevitable climate change rather than actually focusing on trying to build green buildings, for example, or increase density rather than allowing a lot more urban sprawl. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to House Bill 1099. Now, House Bill 1644 also passed. It allows school districts to spend transportation funds on electric vehicle charging stations and other zero-emission fueling stations and to do feasibility studies for transitioning to zero-emission student transportation. Also passing was House Bill 1663, which would establish a limit for the amount of methane emissions from solid waste landfills and require the owner or operator to monitor emissions and install gas collection equipment if emissions exceed a certain limit. House Bill 1691 also passed. That requires the owners and operators of vessels and oil facilities to get certification of financial responsibility from the state in case of an oil or fuel spill. And it adds federally recognized Native tribes as subjects who would be compensated in the event of a fuel spill. And also passing was House Bill 1799, sets statewide goals for composting and other organic waste treatment and require certain local governments to provide compost collection and treatment. So another really good bill. And then Senate Bill 5842 passed. It sets up an executive office of climate policy and accountability within the Department of Ecology to monitor and implement the state's new cap and trade program. And it makes other changes to that law. And that's one I'm probably going to want to take a look at, too, to see what actually passed. My guess is it went through some amendments as well. It'll be interesting to see what that law says. And then there was another interesting bill that's not housing or environmental related that passed both houses and is on its way to the governor. That's House Bill 1851, allows physician assistants and nurse practitioners to provide abortion services, and it prevents the state from penalizing any individual who gets an abortion or who helps a pregnant woman get an abortion. So that was one that was much requested by women's groups, also by healthcare professionals too, who wanted to expand the types of healthcare professionals who could provide abortion services. So that's a great bill. And then, of course, there was a bill that was already signed by the governor and has now gone into law. And again, that's House Bill 1735. That's the bill that rolled back some of the police accountability gains made last year. And I've talked about that the last two or three weeks here. Now, also passing both houses was the big $16.8 billion transportation bill. And that bill includes $3 billion for transit programs and projects, $2.4 billion for the removal of barriers to fish passage, $1.3 billion for bike and pedestrian improvements, $488 million for alternative fuels and electrification of the transportation sector in the state of Washington, $403 million for the electrification of the ferry system, including $210 million for four new hybrid electric ferries, and $193 million for electrification of existing ferries, so retrofitting them, and electrification of terminals. $150 million is also in that bill, in the transportation budget now for an ultra-high-speed rail line. So I think $150 million is probably enough to get the planning done for it, and maybe pay to solicit more federal funding. And then, of course, there will be $3 billion in the budget for preservation and maintenance of transportation infrastructure. Now, the total for multimodal green transportation is about $5.4 billion out of the $16.8 billion transportation bill. That's about 32% of the bill. And although some folks may find that discouraging, thinking that the transportation bill should be primarily green transportation, I have to say it's much higher percentage than we've had in any previous bill transportation budget.
Not to mention all those years when we couldn't even get a transportation budget passed.
Exactly. Now, the rest of the transportation budget will fund the completion of projects started in prior years, and it will fund things like new bridge, freight rail, and road projects. For example, there's $1 billion in the transportation budget now for a new I-5 bridge over the Columbia River. And that's one project that has been stalled for many, many years in the state legislature. And there's also funding for things like HOV lanes in there, too. So you could argue that's green infrastructure. But again, this budget still contains a lot of money for car lanes and improvements for single passenger automobiles, and not nearly enough, I think, for things like electrification. I think the state legislature, particularly the Democrats, were looking for more money from the federal government, especially since this week Joe Biden talked about providing hundreds of thousands of electric vehicle charging stations around the nation. So I think the state Democrats are hoping that there will be more money coming from the federal government for those kinds of things. Now, the revenue to pay for the transportation bill will be drawn from the following. $5.4 billion will come from the new cap and trade program that was passed in the state legislature last year. $3.4 billion will be from federal funds from the federal infrastructure bill that passed last year in the U.S. Congress. $2 billion will come from a tax on fuel exported from Washington state. $1.39 billion will come from an increase in license plate fees for cars and motorcycles. $2 billion will come in transfers from the state's general fund into the transportation fund. So essentially that was extra cash from tax collections this past year and in the coming year. And $956 million will be from new bonds issued by the state. And of course, there are also smaller amounts coming from increases in several fees, like the stolen vehicle check fee, driver's license fees, dealer permits. There's a small amount coming from an increase in the tax on airplane fuels, aircraft fuels, and other things like that. But overall, there's no gas tax increase in this bill. And I think that's really an acknowledgement by the state Democrats that the gas tax is fading as an attractive source of revenue, with the improvement in gas mileage and the wider availability now of electric vehicles. Also, I think the Democrats are beginning to understand that wealthier people can more easily avoid paying the gas tax altogether, because they're the ones who can afford newer model cars that are more fuel efficient and or the pricier electric vehicles that are out there. Although the price is coming down, it's still electric vehicles are pricier than gas powered. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a push this year, although there was a push last year, and it may come in the future. There wasn't a push this year to come up with a new tax on all drivers, like a road usage tax, which would be based on the number of miles on your odometer, for example. But again, that could be coming in future years. I think Senator Saldana was the one who proposed a road usage bill last year that didn't go anywhere in the Senate. But I think she has said that she's going to look at proposing one in the future. Now, Oregon has a road usage tax, and I think the Washington Democrats are studying that to see how it works for the Oregon transportation budget. And they may want to reevaluate how expensive it is to implement that tax and to enforce it, how to collect the readings from people and collect the tax, as well as the best way to structure something like that before they propose a bill. So if you are interested in reading the budget bills or any of the bills that passed, including the various drafts and proposals at various stages and the amendments, the budget bills can be found at fiscal.wa.gov. That's fiscal www.wa.gov. And if you want to see what else passed the state legislature, if you want to track bills and see what's on the House and Senate calendars, you can visit the legislature's website. That's at leg.wa.gov.
So at this point, you know, bills are only alive if they've passed both houses, or where do the fiscal bills stand?
Well, a lot of the time legislators will do, if they couldn't get through their full list of bills that they wanted to pass on Friday, they will scramble around and attach financial clauses. Or they will set aside bills and say this could have a financial aspect to it, and that gives them a few more days to consider them. So there's still some bills alive on the House and the Senate floor. You can take a look on the website and see what's there. And some of them may still get passed because the Democrats will say, hey, you know, this bill has a fiscal impact, so it's got an extra 4 or 5 days. Okay. So there is still an extra 4 or 5 days. The state legislature could still stay in session until the 10th. So we'll see.
Okay. All right. Moving along, the proposed new state capital gains tax. Actually, it's not proposed. It is, but not for long.
Yeah. Douglas County judge struck down the state capital gains tax, which was passed last year by the state legislature. This was widely expected that a lower court in the state would overturn this bill that was passed. Douglas County Superior Court Judge Brian Huber ruled that the tax was a form of income tax, which is unconstitutional in Washington state. In addition, he ruled that because income is considered property in Washington state, any tax on property under the state constitution must be uniform and not graduated. The capital gains tax would exempt all capital gains under $250,000 per year for an individual. In addition, it exempts gains from certain classes of assets, like pension plans, 401ks, and IRAs, so all retirement accounts are exempted. Most real estate is exempted. So are timber and timberlands, livestock, certain agricultural property that's depreciable, some auto dealerships, and sole proprietor businesses with gross revenue under $6 million per year. So again, only the very wealthiest Washingtonians would pay that tax, and the tax rate is 7%. Now, Attorney General Bob Ferguson said that this was widely expected, that the Douglas County Superior Court judge would overrule it. And Ferguson then agreed that he will indeed appeal that ruling, so that now it's on its way to the Washington State Supreme Court. Now, if the tax... go ahead.
The Seattle Times coverage of this was deeply misleading.
I know.
A bitter loss for progressives. Well, no, I mean, no. This was passed. This was passed, and the bill was crafted with the expectation that it would go to the Supreme Court, and with the hope that that ruling would finally overturn the state's archaic reliance on essentially a flat tax principle. And banning of income taxes, because, you know, Washington state has actually the most regressive tax system in the country. And people, I mean, we've been talking about this, you know, basically, but from the time we started talking about this, we could have, you know, raised a kid to adulthood. I mean, it's been going on that long. This was an intentional plan by progressives to get that ban on graduated income taxes overturned. So it was entirely expected. Meanwhile, the conservatives who filed suit on this, I can't imagine there's very many people in Douglas County who actually would have to pay this tax. It's a very small, very rural, and not very populated or wealthy county.
Yeah. And that's something
the wealth
that,
is all here.
That's something that Ferguson's office is arguing on this case, is that it should be dismissed because none of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit would actually have to pay the tax. Although Judge Huber refused to go that route, and he basically with the understanding that, you know, the attorney general can't know who's going to be subject to the tax until that person actually sells an asset,
I'm fairly confident that I would not be subjected to that tax.
Yeah, I understand that principle, as you don't know what you're going to get for something till you sell it. However, again, I kind of agree with the Democrats that only a very small number of people in the state of Washington would be paying the tax, and probably they would be people for whom the tax would be not very much in terms of their overall annual income.
Yeah, the last time I drove through Waterville, I don't remember seeing a whole lot of, you know, mansions and stuff. So
no. No, those are tend to be here on the west of the Cascades. And
yes.
I know before we started, Jav, you made the comment that they had to look for a sympathetic court on the east side of the state. And yeah, I was thinking, nobody here in a western county would be willing to overturn this law, or be as sympathetic to overturning it. Now, I should mention too that the Democrats are expecting the capital gains tax to bring in about $500 million per year, so about $500 million per year into the state's budget. So that gives you some idea of exactly how wealthy some of the wealthiest folks here in Washington state are. And I would agree with that. And I would just add too that because of our lack of income taxes, we've attracted a lot of very wealthy people as Washington state residents. And they live here precisely because they are not taxed hardly at all on their income.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Their property taxes are reasonable instead of outrageous. The sales tax doesn't impact them as much as it does a person at my income level or below. And they pay no state income tax. And that's why we have so many very, very wealthy people in Washington state.
Particularly who've come from California, which has, you know, relatively high income taxes.
Yes, indeed.
Would the state capital gains tax affect the LLCs that have continued to acquire very nice apartments and condos?
Well, it depends on what they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
So most real estate is exempt from the tax. So that tells you something right there.
All right.
Okay. So if it's, say it's an LLC that owns timberland and they sell timber, they cut and sell timber, you know, they wouldn't pay the tax.
Right.
Yeah.
But here in Seattle, there's a real problem with foreign corporations coming in and buying up housing.
No. Yeah, I don't think they would. No.
Okay. So they're safe.
I know. Okay. And that's the thing. If there was a tax on all sales over $250,000, you know, then the collections would be much, much higher. But the real estate industry lobbied very, very hard for that exemption. And if we,
I'll
you know, think a minute about what the state could collect if we had a graduated income tax too. Okay.
Or in the case of real estate, we could end up
cutting way back on property taxes and on the sales tax if we had a graduated income tax. And that's the whole point, right? Is that a graduated income tax would be, tax fairness for people on the lower end of the income scale versus what they're paying now.
Yeah, and a lot of that foreign real estate that Mike is talking about came here from BC after they instituted a specific tax on foreign ownership of real estate. Because, of course, in Metro Vancouver, you know, they got a lot of money from Asia. And it drove the real estate prices to insane levels. So
a lot of
that money has flowed here.
A lot of money that was taken out of foreign countries in order to shelter it from taxes and to shelter assets from, say, government seizure in countries like China, for example, flowed into the property markets here as well as Vancouver. So we're starting to feel the impact of that. And
yeah,
nobody's
That started when Hong Kong was repatriated in 1999. So that tells you how long it's been an issue.
Yeah.
And then part of that is affecting our local elections here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Indirectly.
Yes.
So, all right. Moving on, this week's COVID updates.
Yeah. Governor Inslee moved up his date for the lifting of the mask mandate because the pandemic is all over now. Now, to be fair, new infection rates are dropping, but they are still about double what they were at the height of the Delta pandemic. So, you know, we're not out of the pandemic yet.
Yeah. And community transmission is still really high.
I know this is a broken record and we keep saying the same thing every week, but it keeps being true every week. Mm-hmm. Just because you want the pandemic to be over doesn't mean it actually is. And I think, you know, a lot of these decisions here and around the country are being politically driven by, you know, elected officials who can read the room. They see that people are tired of the public health restrictions and they're becoming less and less able to enforce them. So we're just going to let it rip. And, you know, my concern, of course, is that this is a real-time experiment in public health. You know, we have a relatively high vaccination rate in King County and in Washington State that affords some measure of protection, but the rate at which people have gotten booster shots is still relatively low. And we know that Omicron, which is still the dominant variant in Washington State and around the country, we know that Omicron has breakthrough cases with just the original two-shot regimen of vaccines that the booster shot affords good protection against Omicron, but if you've just had those initial two shots, it's not going to protect you, particularly if it's been, you know, more than 8 or 9 months ago at this point. You know, because the efficacy of the vaccines degrade over time. So, you know, keep wearing the masks. That's all I can say. Keep washing your hands. Stay away from people.
The end of the mask mandate now here in Washington State, it was at March 21st, which was a really easy number to remember because it was around the spring equinox. But now it's been moved up 9 days to the 12th. So you have to, in your mind, switch that 2 and 1 around. Masks will still be required in healthcare facilities and while riding public transit and in any businesses that require it. Okay. So you're going to have to read signs before you enter. Okay. I know a lot of people have trouble with reading signs.
That sounds pretty onerous to me.
Sounds pretty tough, right? And you'll have to carry your vaccination card with you as well, because there may be some businesses and places that will require you to prove you've been vaccinated. Now, on March 12th, you will no longer have to wear a mask in grocery stores, retail stores, bars, restaurants, theaters, stadiums, and schools and school buses. And yes, I know that is weird, that you and I and other adults will have to wear a mask on a metro bus, but that kids will be able to go without masks on school buses. That is weird, and it doesn't make any sense. But that's the way it is. So,
yeah.
And of course, you know, I mean, as Job said, people are going to have to use your judgment, too. If you're going to visit grandma, you know, she may have been vaccinated and boosted, but her immune system is still not as strong as yours. So it may be a good idea to wear a mask.
Yep.
And this is happening in other states and areas across the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were major developments. This week, New York City dropped a lot of its requirements. The mask mandate for public schools, proof of vaccination for restaurants and bars and so forth. LA County lifted nearly all of its indoor mask and vaccine verification requirements. So this is happening in major cities across the country. And, you know, they're looking at the same public health data that new cases are down, but they're not down nearly enough yet that people can be complacent. So the fear, of course,
the reason they're down is because we've been taking precautions because of Omicron, right? So what's going to happen when we stop wearing masks?
Well, you know, every time we get a wave like this, the backside of the wave, people will want to declare that the pandemic is over. And then, of course, a new variant hits.
Exactly.
Because that opening has been created. So, you know, the hope is that as the weather warms up, and people go outside more, we'll have less community transmission. But we are not there yet. We're just not.
Well, let's move on to developments this week with the January 6th committee.
Yeah, we had a filing in a civil suit in California in which the January 6th special committee in the House of Representatives did a paint by numbers thing for the Justice Department in terms of how they could pursue criminal charges against Donald Trump. They laid out what specific federal charges they believe he'd violated, what the case was for making those charges, and a lot of it hinged around what they say is evidence that Donald Trump knew perfectly well that he had lost the election and he was committing fraud against the American people by insisting that he had not lost the election. That may seem like obvious to those of us who live on, you know, Earth One, but it is a criminal charge, and they were, you know, squarely putting the pressure on Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice to pursue those charges. It has been over a year now, and Trump has continued to fundraise very lucratively off of that big lie. So, you know, this is an ongoing crime that we're watching in real time. The January 6th committee itself does not have authority to pursue criminal charges. It has to refer them to the Department of Justice, who then can decide whether or not to prosecute. And a lot of people would very much like to see some progress on that, particularly since the Manhattan DA's case on tax charges seems to have fallen apart. That the new DA there, Alvin Bragg, has decided not to pursue charges, it seems like. They're saying that the investigation is ongoing, but the two primary litigators who were, presenting evidence to a grand jury both resigned last month, and that grand jury is set to expire next month. So, the clock is ticking, and still Trump is walking free.
All right. Moving on, the Florida legislature passing a bill banning abortion this week?
Yes, after 15 weeks, which is the same length of time as was passed in Mississippi last year, and that particular law is going before the Supreme Court. They're expected to rule in this next session in June. So this is Florida situating itself to make sure that, you know, if the Supreme Court does overturn Roe v. Wade in that Mississippi case, that that their new law will be, immune to court challenge. It can go into effect immediately. That's what that is about. So, you know, despite all the shenanigans around COVID and around, all the other idiocies that happen in Florida on a regular basis, they still haven't forgotten their misogyny. That's still a bedrock core principle, it seems like. So, yeah, I expect to see laws like that passed in other states as well as we get closer to the Supreme Court decision.
All right. Moving on, Brett Hankison found not guilty.
Yes, he was the only officer in Louisville who was charged in the conjunction with the Breonna Taylor killing in 2020. And Hankison was not charged with Taylor's killing. He was charged with recklessly firing his weapon into adjacent apartments. Now, in other words, he is basically charged with being a really bad shot. He was found not guilty because his defense argued that it was a chaotic situation. He didn't know where gunfire was coming from, et cetera, et cetera. So the upshot of that is that nobody was convicted of anything in relation to Taylor's killing. And that's every bit as outrageous now as it was 2 years ago.
Just to remind people, Breonna Taylor was shot while she was in her bed in her home. Okay. Police were using a no-knock warrant to break into her apartment in the middle of the night and started shooting because they thought her partner kind of flew out of bed. You know, who are these people breaking into our home, right? And they shot him. They shot at him, and they ended up killing her.
Yeah. And there is federal legislation.
So no one prosecuted even for reckless endangerment or anything.
No, and there was legislation passed by the House of Representatives last year that would ban no-knock warrants. Kentucky went ahead and banned them, but they would ban at the federal level. But of course, it's being blocked by Republicans in the Senate. Yeah. So that bill still languishes. The criminal justice reform bill, along with many other bills, voting rights protection and so forth, that are really stuck because of the filibuster in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make sure we have time to talk about Ukraine. So, and I'd be nice if we could also talk about the State of the Union. So can we take Ukraine first and then do State of the Union after that? Does that work?
Sure, we can do the State of the Union if we have time.
Okay.
Yeah, well, there's a lot happened in Ukraine this week, and it's a very different situation now than it was a week ago. I think a lot of people who weren't paying careful attention were kind of shocked that we nearly had a nuclear meltdown this week. The Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant was actively being fired upon, and a fire broke out in one of the administrative buildings. It wasn't initially clear where the fire was coming from. And, I was watching this in real time. We're already in World War III in the sense that this is a global war. It already is. We're seeing this with economic sanctions. This is the first major war we've had in the era of social media. And I could literally go online and watch a live stream of the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhzhia as it was on fire. And as firefighters were being prevented by active warfare from accessing the facility. Now, apparently, none of the actual reactor areas were damaged by the fire, and only one of the six cooling towers was in active use at the time. But I think it calls in time.
Calls into question what Russia is doing in terms of trying to identify military targets versus civilian targets, or targets that, like this power plant, should absolutely not be on the list of or should be on some separate list of do not target, right? There have been many, many instances of the Russian military targeting civilian homes, particularly large apartment buildings, even evidence that they may have targeted medical facilities, which is a violation of international law, and
yes,
targeting government buildings where many civilians would be working. You know, those are not yeah, considered military targets.
So anybody who's ever been in that part of the world, and this is true of Ukraine as well as Russia, the major cities are dominated architecturally by these butt ugly big concrete Soviet era apartment buildings that may be, you know, 15, 20 stories high. And they're being targeted and they're being hit routinely. We're seeing footage of this over and over and over.
Yeah. And that's what's causing the massive exodus of so many people out of the Ukraine right now, is it's just not safe for the folks who would live in these large apartment buildings. So, you know, and they're being driven out because those are now considered by the Russian military as acceptable targets.
And, you know, you can understand why, as long as you don't care about the loss of human life, because, you know, if Russia is looking forward to the day when they occupy these cities, those big buildings lining the streets, you know, it's a perfect setup for snipers, for guerrilla warfare. You know, it's really apparent, and we've seen this over and over in some of the footage, that the Ukrainians aren't going to give up. They're going to keep fighting after their cities are taken over. So this is going to go on for a while, and it's going to be very ugly. And, you know, the UN is now estimating that this could generate 4 million refugees in Europe. We have seen that kind of displacement before. The estimate at one point was 6 million when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. But, you know, that was confined to poor countries in the Middle East and non-white people, so we didn't care as much. I hate to be that cynical about it, but I think that's fairly accurate. It is definitely a humanitarian crisis. I have a friend who's actually leaving for the Western Ukrainian city of Lviv, for refugee assistance. She's leaving this weekend. So, you know, good luck to her. And we've seen remarkable unanimity among countries in the West, isolating Russia. When Switzerland is joining the list of countries that have, sanctioned Russia, this is a country that stayed neutral through Hitler. It's like, you know, well, yeah, Hitler was okay, but Putin, he's a step too far. That's how people are viewing this. And, Putin this week, basically issued a veiled threat of nuclear weapons if NATO gets involved militarily. That is why NATO is so reluctant to do no-fly zone, for example, which a lot of people are pushing for. Because, you know, you can't enforce a no-fly zone.
Too, when I'm talking about the State of the Union.
Okay, sure. Mm-hmm. You can't enforce a no-fly zone without engaging Russia in direct warfare. And that is an easy path to World War III. And it's a path that Putin seems willing to take. And that's scaring a lot of people who are experts in the region or who know him. For example, Michael McFaul is the former U.S. ambassador to Russia and who has, you know, dealt with Putin for 20 years. And he thinks Putin has lost it. He is fully capable of, pursuing nuclear war. If it'll keep him in power, if he thinks it'll keep him in power. So it's a very, very scary time, for a lot of reasons. And the carnage in Ukraine is only going to increase. It's only going to increase the pressure for people to do something. But it's a real moral dilemma for people who, are paid to make these decisions. You know, it's why presidency is a tough job. because, you know, you're making life and death decisions on a very, very broad scale.
As I said in the past, too, that the president does two really big things, right? He oversees the enforcement of laws in the United States, and he's our representative to the world. He makes big decisions in terms of international issues. So that's something that I think one of the things Putin is doing is he's saying, well, you have a weak America has a weak president now.
And it's not the president
that I wanted. So let's see how far we can push him.
Yeah, I think Putin has a personality very similar to Donald Trump in terms of how people might think about it. So he's always going to double down. He's never going to admit he's wrong. And if he gets away with something like, say, in Georgia or Crimea, he's going to push the envelope to see how far he can go. This has been Trump's consistent behavior throughout his life, and it has been Putin's behavior as well. I think the two of them understood each other. Trump has been very isolated. It's been very amusing to watch the Republican Party try and contort itself into condemning Russia while still being loyal to Donald Trump, who won't condemn
Russia.
No. And I mean that, you know, I mean, Putin has gotten more mileage out of that P tape, I swear. Because he can do anything and Donald Trump won't condemn him. Uh-huh. The other interesting thing has been the corporate effort to flee Russia. And yesterday, and Maria, maybe you've seen more details on this than I have, but Microsoft announced that it was pulling sale of all products from Russia. Now, does that mean that it's no longer going to sell its software updates or its operating systems? I mean, that could bring the Russian economy to a standstill pretty quickly, I would think. Depending on what exactly they mean by that. And I haven't seen any clarification. I also haven't seen anything in the tech media.
Yeah, I would think that would be really, really hard to enforce since Microsoft and a whole bunch of other software vendors have been pushing people to go into the cloud. How exactly do you determine whether a new customer is purchasing Office 365 monthly subscription, from Russia? Maybe their email address has .ru on the end of it, but it's pretty easy to get around that if you really need to use Office 365 in the cloud. So I just don't know how Microsoft is going to be able to enforce that.
Yeah, so, good point.
Anyway.
It's good PR.
It certainly is. Yeah. Tech companies, they're the heroes. They're on board, right?
Yeah. No. The other thing from Russia's standpoint, they've passed this new law as of yesterday that essentially stifles dissent. It gives up to 15 years imprisonment for anybody who disparages the Russian military. Now, disparaging the Russian military can mean calling it a war or an invasion as opposed to, say, a special military operation, which is what the propagandists in Russia are calling it. But you've seen BBC and CNN and Bloomberg, among other news agencies, close their Moscow bureaus because, they can't broadcast with that kind of and put their reporters in that kind of risk. And you've also continued to see major, major demonstrations. Thousands of people have been arrested across Russia protesting what they know is this war. Russia has banned Twitter and banned Facebook, but they have not banned all sorts of other social media platforms that people use in Russia. Telegram is popular there. WhatsApp is popular there, and so forth. And, these other platforms that don't have the kind of market share of Twitter or Facebook, at least not in the West, there's that. People are getting information through that. And they also bear in mind that, for many, many, many years, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. And so you have families who are, you know, intermarried with Ukrainians. Everybody in Russia knows somebody in Ukraine. And so they're hearing directly from their relatives about what's going on in Ukraine, that it's not just this limited military operation in the east of the country, but that Russia is literally, you know, carpet bombing major cities like Kiev and Kharkiv. You know, so people in Russia know what's going on. That's why you're seeing these major demonstrations. And that's why you're seeing the Russian government, you know, really trying to clamp down on any kind of domestic dissent. And of course, people are being affected economically as well by the sanctions in the West. So it's a very volatile situation. And, yeah, there's a reason why it has been the main news story in the news, you know, day after day for this past 8 days. Because it can go sideways in any number of different ways. It's not a predictable situation at all.
Yeah. And so I'd like to talk for a few minutes about the State of the Union address.
Yeah. Yeah.
The State of the Union address, just my 6 or 7 takeaways from it, you know, right in the first, we knew exactly what Biden was going to talk about for an hour, because right in the first minute or two, he mentioned two of his main themes, COVID-19 and Vladimir Putin, right? So that was
I was surprised he didn't spend more time at the beginning on Ukraine.
What he said was extremely important, and that's
yes, it was. Let's talk
my,
about that.
Two of my big takeaways from it is one is that he mentioned, quote, "I spent countless hours unifying our European allies." This is after he was talking about, you know, the U.S. building a coalition of nations all over the world, including in the Americas and Asia and Africa and stuff. Well, we know that's not true, right? We know China is trying to be neutral in this whole process, right? They have not condemned Russia, and African countries, many African countries who've gotten assistance from Russia have not stepped up and condemned the invasion. And then, of course, Biden says, well, you know, I've been working with our European allies, right? So then you know what he's going to talk about. He's going to talk about NATO, right? The second thing that I really want to point out, my takeaway from it, and this is a direct quote from his speech, our forces, and he's talking about U.S. forces, military forces, right? Our forces are not engaged and will not engage in the conflict with Russian forces in Ukraine. Okay, he's basically saying we're not going to help the Ukrainian people, right? He goes on to say our forces are not going to Europe to fight in Ukraine, but to defend our NATO allies in the event that Putin decides to keep moving west. Okay, so there he basically said, you know, in the early part of his State of the Union address, okay, this is what the situation is. We're not getting involved in Ukraine, but if Putin's and his military steps one inch across the border of Ukraine into any of the surrounding countries, then it's on, you know?
Yep.
So, and it's essentially to protect
NATO. And he has said that. Excuse me. He has said that consistently over the past week.
Yeah.
So that
I think is really important. And then of course he starts talking about the impact on Americans, right? Because that's really what counts, not the impact on Ukraine or necessarily the countries around them or even the impact on the world in terms of democracy and security. He talked mainly about gas prices here at home and inflation as the big ups and downs in the market as the big impact of the war in Ukraine, which really kind of shows you, you know, these are the cold sort of calculations that capitalists make, you know, when it comes to violence in the world. You know, what is the economic impact on the people who pay who pay taxes in my country and therefore, you know, pay my salary, right?
Yeah, and as well as it's a midterm year.
Oh, yes.
So
exactly.
That calculation is.
Yeah. So then, too. You know, so then he was done with Ukraine, right? And he mentioned the infrastructure bill that the Democrats passed. This is like my fourth big takeaway. And the thing that I think was most central to that was that it was showing up China for their Belts and Roads program, right? where he mentions it is going to transform America to put us on a path to win the economic competition of the 21st century that we face with the rest of the world, particularly China. So that's essentially saying, hey, okay, the infrastructure plan, you know, it's not that our infrastructure is falling apart and dang, it's past due for fixing. It's that, you know, we're in a competition with China. That's what's important.
And, you know, people don't know what China has actually been doing. They have built in the last 20 years a network of high-speed rail that crisscrosses the country, tens and hundreds of thousands of miles of track that moves enormous numbers of people each year. It's really the equivalent of the interstate system in the United States in the 50s, except instead of roads, it's, you know, anticipating a future without fossil fuel.
And you know, China has also been using its Belt and Roads program to make allies around the world by helping developing nations to fund infrastructure projects and in their countries. And so I kind of found it interesting that Biden would compare infrastructure here at home with China's Belt and Roads program. And
yeah, it is apples and oranges. Yeah,
I know. So that's kind of interesting. And then my final takeaway that I think I have some time to mention is towards the end of his speech. This is another quote I'm going to read for you. Quote, we should all agree the answer is not to defund the police. It's to fund the police. Fund them with resources and training they need to protect their communities.
Okay. I was grinding my teeth through that.
And you were not alone, you know?
Yes.
So, because, you know, it's not.
Anybody who has followed those issues know that is not the answer.
Yeah. You know, and it's not as if we didn't know that this was his policy, because this has been his policy since way before he even ran for president. You know, he's always been pro-police. He's always been pro crackdown on crime, you know, and he's always been from that wing of the Democratic Party that is three strikes, you're out, you know, all of that stuff. So it was just interesting to hear it again now, you know.
So. Yeah, and it really is sort of seeding that ground to conservative critics of the protests in 2020, and you know, saying yeah, that's legitimate, you know, and I'm with you on that, mm-hmm. you know, because and dismissing the actual concerns of people who were in the streets in 2020.
Yeah, there's no nuance there at all. You know, no concession at all to the progressive folks in his party. Just I'm with the Republicans. Fund the police.
Yeah, it's awful. Awful framing.
Those were my big takeaways. There was a lot more there in the State of the Union address, but those were the things that really stood out to me.
And you know, to me, I mean, particularly in the context of a midterm year. You know, you want, and he had the perfect opening for it with the Ukraine situation. Democrats think they're going to win elections because they're better on policy. People do not vote on the basis of policy. They're voting on the basis of emotion and partisanship and tribalism, at least right now. That's, you know, you cannot win the argument, you know, when people aren't even arguing policy. And, you know, his State of the Union address, I thought, was very similar to addresses by previous presidents in a lot of years, in that it was just this laundry list of policy stances. And, you know, people tune out to that stuff. They don't really care. They don't follow it. And they don't understand, you know, what the impediments are to getting things done in Washington. So, yeah, I thought that you know, his delivery was fine. A lot of the aesthetics of the address were fine. But politically, I didn't think it was very effective. It's one of the few times that people actually tune into the president.
Yeah.